My castaway this week is a cellist. Her musical talent has made her one of the most distinguished members of the English Chamber Orchestra, with whom she's toured all over the world. Until the early 80s, however, there was one country which she always refused to visit. That country was Germany, where, at the age of 18, she found herself a Jewish prisoner in Auschwitz. Because she could play the cello, she survived. She was moved to Belsen, where she almost didn't. Hers is a remarkable story which remained untold until she decided to reveal it herself, nearly 50 years after the war had ended. Through music, she's written, we were able to raise ourselves high above the inferno of Auschwitz into spheres where we could not be touched by the degradation of concentration camp existence. She is Anita Lasker-Valfish. It's a simple truth, isn't it, Anita, that if you hadn't played the cello, you wouldn't be here today?
Yes. I mean, it's a simple fact that we were needed at the time. They wanted an orchestra, so they needed the people who played in that orchestra. So it would have been a little bit foolish to stick us straight in the gas chamber.
But when you arrived in that camp and you told somebody, I think on your first day...
Oh, yes, that's right. Somebody said, oh, yes, oh, fantastic, you play the cello, there's an orchestra here. Yes, you'll be saved.
Did you understand what it meant?
No, I had no idea. Well, I didn't exactly come with high hopes into Auschwitz because I knew what was going on there. But, it was very nice to hear that it was a good thing that I played the cello. I only mentioned it really accidentally.
How big was the orchestra? How good was it?
We were roughly about 40 people. How good was it is very difficult for me to say in retrospect. It wasn't as bad as it should have been, considering that hardly anybody was really a trained musician. But Alma Rosé being Alma Rosé...
She was the leader...
She was the conductor, yes. She had such enormously high standards.
But do you think she understood, perhaps, that this was the salvation of all of you?
I don't think it was motivated by fear. By fear of the SS, if we don't play well, they'd put us in a gas chamber. I don't think so. It was an escape somehow into excellence. Mm. I mean, it sounds totally ridiculous in the context, but...
But it was the same for you, in a sense, wasn't it? That playing the cello gave you an identity, which
yeah,
all of those
absolutely.
Thousands of other people
absolutely.
In the camp didn't have.
Yeah. I wasn't just a number, but one could actually say the cellist.
But who did you play for? When?
Well, we had a job, a prescribed job. We played marches in the morning for the people who walked out of the camp, and there were thousands and thousands who walked out to work in the factories. We played concerts on Sundays... Between the two camps, there was an A and B camp in Birkenau. And the SS would come, or they would come into the block and ask for certain pieces or whatever.
And you played, did you not, for the infamous Dr. Mengele?
Yeah.
How did you feel when you played for such people? I mean, did you have any feelings, or did you just go cold?
I don't think we gave ourselves time to feel anything.
Because you knew what they were doing, didn't you?
Of course we knew what they were doing.
How could you entertain them, really, is I suppose what one's asking.
Yeah, but what was the alternative?
No, you didn't have a choice.
Yeah.
Tell me about your first record.
Well, my first record, which brings me back to my youth, is really Death and the Maiden, because we played a lot of chamber music at home. My mother was a very, very good violinist, and I remember with special affection Schubert's Death and the Maiden, and how I loved playing the cello variation in the slow movement.
Thank you. part of the second movement of Schubert's string quartet in D minor, Death and the Maiden, played by the Amadeus Quartet, which you played, Anita Lasker-Velfisch, with your mother as a girl. You'd been off to Berlin, I think, to study the cello, hadn't you?
Yes, because there came a point when, in the town where I come from, Breslau, there weren't any people left who would teach me, Jewish teachers. And it was extremely dangerous for a non-Jewish German to be seen to teach a Jewish child. So,
this was when, in the 30s?
That was would have been in 38, 39, yes.
And your father was a lawyer?
Yes.
I mean, obviously, the whole family would have been aware, for the reason you just said, not least, of this growth of anti-Semitism. Why on earth didn't he organise you all out of there?
Well, I think the fact that he was a lawyer was a very great hindrance, because for a lawyer it is very difficult to emigrate with a family of three children. What are you going to do in a foreign country where you haven't studied the law of that country? I think that probably kept him. Had he known what is ahead, he wouldn't have cared less whether he could.
So you all stayed except for an older sister?
Except my elder sister, who just left, yeah.
But you lived in very straitened circumstances, obviously.
Eventually, yes. Eventually we had to leave our flat, and we moved in with an aunt, and we lived on top of one another till 1942.
And you didn't go to school because then there were no
Jewish
schools?
Well, the schools had closed by then, and we were made to go to do war work in a factory.
What sort of factory?
Paper factory. I'm a great expert in making toilet paper.
And then finally, in April 1942, they came for your parents.
They came for my parents, but we stayed behind because we weren't on the list.
Did your parents know that this was the end? Or?
Well, I think, you know, looking back, I think my father knew quite well, because obviously we wanted to stay together and we wanted to go with them. And my father said, well, I will go to the Gestapo and ask whether you can come. It sounds a little bit ridiculous now in retrospect. And he left the house and he came back a few minutes later and said, I'm sorry, you can't come. Because where we are going, you get there soon enough. If I look back on that situation now, I'm pretty sure that my father knew exactly where they were going. It's unthinkable, really, what you feel as a parent. Mm.
You would have been 16 at the
yeah.
time. Did you ever find out exactly what happened to them?
Not exactly, but pretty exactly, that they were sent to a place called Izbica. And the method of killing people there was that they had to dig their graves and were shot into the graves. But I have no actual 100% confirmation of that, but I can well believe it. That's what happened.
So you two girls, you and your sister, were left alone with your grandmother.
Yeah.
And then eventually she was taken too.
She was taken as well, yes.
How did you two girls survive?
We still remained in the flat, but we didn't stay there very long because we were minors. And we had to leave the flat and go into an orphanage.
But eventually, you tried to make a dash for France, but you were caught,
yeah.
You were imprisoned, and finally, you and your sister were separated and you were sent off to Auschwitz. Let's pause in your story there and have some more music. Tell me about the second piece.
Mozart's Don Giovanni. It brings back wonderful memories of Daniel Barenboim in Edinburgh. I was so unbelievably impressed by it. It's the most wonderful piece of music. And Daniel, of course, did it most beautifully. So it was very difficult to choose a record, but I thought Don Giovanni covers a marvelous bit of Mozart, at least.
Oh,
Part of the final act, the hell scene of Mozart's Don Giovanni, sung by Roger Sawyer, Geraint Evans and the Scottish Opera Chorus, with the English Chamber Orchestra, conducted by Daniel Barenboim. What were your, may I ask this, what were your first impressions of Auschwitz, Anita? You know, when you recall that moment, what images come into your mind?
People in black capes and dogs barking and a lot of noise, screaming, and a horrendous smell.
And you had to file in, and very soon afterwards your head was shaved and you were tattooed
yes,
with a number.
That's right.
On your arm. It's still there, I presume.
Oh, yes.
It was a vast camp, but I take it everybody knew what was going on, that people were being systematically
Absolutely.
Gassed. You actually lived, didn't you, in a hut opposite the gas chamber?
Yeah.
So you saw them?
Absolutely. I mean, I saw the people walking in. There's no secret.
Knowing what they were going into?
Well, you know how they arranged it. They said that you're going to have a bath. And they had special hooks with numbers on and told the people to put their clothes neatly so they can find them again. And, you know, and you like to think that, well, if that's the case, then everything must be okay. So the actual cleverness behind it is mind-boggling. Because can you imagine what would happen if thousands of people suddenly started revolting like they did in some places? But, I mean, they were led like sheep.
So you lived, because you knew, those of you who went on surviving knew, you lived, therefore, with constant fear.
Somehow you come to terms with eventually they're going to get you. But whilst they haven't got you, you just carry on. I think one of the ingredients of survival was to be with other people. I think anybody on their own really didn't have a chance. But the fact that we were an orchestra, and I mean, I'm still see the people that are still alive now. We still keep in touch, you know, and we really looked after each other and bullied each other. And
did you? So you bullied each other.
We bullied each other.
Anybody?
Yes, you could see if people started perhaps not to wash every day, or well, you can see when people start giving up.
And did your religion help? I mean, was there any room for God?
No, I don't have that problem. To me, I don't think of God as a man sitting up there, making sure that everything is all right, because everything was all wrong.
But your faith was in other people, as you say.
My faith is in other people. Yes. Not that I have that much faith in other people, but somehow in something bigger than us.
You do believe there's something bigger.
There's
some ultimate good that will triumph over evil, do you?
Well, I hope.
Tell me about your third record.
My third record is the Matthew Passion. To me, the Matthew Passion with Karl Richter is the most impressive among the hundreds of Matthew Passions that I've played. And I chose this particular chorus because, to me, there is so much consolation in that music. You know, after all the big drama that's happened, I find it very consoling. That's why I love this particularly.
Chorus Wir setzen uns mit Tränen nieder from Bach's St. Matthew Passion with the Munich Bach Choir and Orchestra conducted by Karl Richter. So you were in Auschwitz, Anita, for nearly a year, and your sister had turned up too, and you were able to help her survive. And then one day you were lined up and put in a cattle truck for Belsen. What did you think that meant?
We thought, well, this probably means that we'll survive. At least we didn't go into the gas chamber. That's all we thought. We were glad to be leaving Auschwitz, I can assure you.
But you didn't really know where you were going.
We didn't know where we were going, and when we did find out, I don't know how, somebody said, oh, Belsen, oh, that's a very good place. That is a convalescent camp.
What it wasn't, of course, was it was an extermination camp.
It wasn't actually an extermination camp. It was a camp where people perished. There were no gas chambers there. No need for gas chambers. You just died of disease, of starvation.
How close did you come to perishing?
Well, I think another week and we probably wouldn't have made it because there was no food left. No food and no water.
But as I understand it, there were, in fact,
Absolutely. Great
warehouses full
Absolutely,
of the stuff.
Absolutely, yeah.
It was just locked up. Yeah. And blankets that yeah. might have kept you warm.
Mm-hmm.
You must have asked yourself, suffering all of that, you know, how could these people... I mean, the people who were in charge of you were, before all this started, quite ordinary people.
If you met these people in the street, you wouldn't know what they were up to. I think this is the most frightening thing about the whole event, is that you don't have to be a monster to be able to descend to that sort of depth.
How does it happen, then? Can you explain?
God knows. Well, I think enough clever propaganda, brainwashing. And you know the people that were told that the Jews are subhuman. Mind you, I must also add that I don't want to forget the many, many non-Jewish people who also perished. I think it's important to bring this in. But if you were fed with your mother's milk that Jews are subhuman, and then you reduce them to subhumans, which we were, then it's quite easy, actually, to hate them and to say, oh, well, if they look like that, it's dreadful. We'll do away with them.
Tell me about record number four.
Record number four has to do with Benjamin Britten, who played a very important part in my musical career. He and Yehudi Menuhin came in 1945 to Belsen on a sort of tour where they played in liberated camps. And I went to this concert, and I wrote a letter about this concert to my cousin the next day. And I kept talking about this pianist. And years later, I found out that this pianist was, in fact, Benjamin Britten. And then I was very privileged with the English Chamber Orchestra for years and years to play in the Aldborough Festival. And I remember particularly recording the Frank Bridge Variations, and that we recorded the Moto Perpetuo in one single take, which is totally unheard of. But I can see it now. You're sitting there. Well, that was fantastic. That's it.
One of Benjamin Britten's variations on a theme of Frank Bridge, the Moto Perpetuo, played by the English Chamber Orchestra, conducted by Benjamin Britten. Tell me about the liberation, Anita Laskavalfish, April the 15th, 1945. Could you take on board the full reality that it was over? It was really over.
With difficulty. It was almost too much to take on board. It sort of seeped in slowly, really, what was happening, and the fact that people in uniform, this time British uniforms, were not your enemies.
Yeah.
I mean, it takes quite a bit of getting used to if you lived for years and years thinking that anybody in uniform is going to be after you.
So you were suspicious of them, in a sense. And they were so appalled by
they
what
were so
they
appalled,
found
yes.
that it must have been...
They couldn't believe it. Mm. They couldn't believe it. I mean, I've spoken to people who've actually been there on the first days. It was the smell, really, That was so awful, because by the time we were liberated, we were surrounded by dead bodies who hadn't been buried, and it was very hot by then.
But you were immune to all
didn't,
that,
no, no, we just moved about it. It was totally meaningless. It became totally meaningless.
Hmm. And then, I think, terrible things happened, didn't they? Because then the food was discovered, and then people ate too much too quickly. So
normal reaction, you see, of people who see starving people is to give them something to eat without realizing that, in fact, a tin of corned beef is not the food for somebody who hasn't been eating. So a lot of mistakes were made, but, you know, not with intent.
And you subsequently gave evidence at the Lunenberg trials against your jailers, all of whom, the ones on trial anyway, mm-hmm. were eventually hanged. And yet you've called those trials a huge farce. They made you very angry. Why?
Because you can't apply the concept of British law to things that happened there. What particularly struck me at the time is the questions I was asked, like in a proper trial, you ask questions. Did you see so-and-so kill somebody? And you would say, yes. What day was it? What time was it? I mean, these are all ridiculous questions.
You couldn't possibly...
First of all, I couldn't possibly know. And what relevance has it got anyway? We were talking about millions of murdered people. I mean, I stood in that witness box and I felt like a liar because I couldn't say at what time so-and-so had killed somebody else.
And what about today? What do you say to those people who believe that the hunt for former Nazi criminals should be ended, that you know, if they're found, the
argument is they're
too old?
I don't agree with it. What do you mean too old? Nobody's ever too old. You know, and I'm not talking out of a desire for revenge, but what example do we set the next generation if we actually say, well, you've murdered thousands of people, but now so many years have gone by, so let's forget it.
Tell me about record number 5.
I used to be a regular visitor to Jacqueline Dupré when she was very ill, and we always used to play records when I sat with her, and it was always the Schumann Concerto. So I think of Jacqueline Dupré, and I also think of my son. I met after the liberation an Italian cellist by the name of Giuseppe Selmi, who was liberated in an Italian prison camp. And we formed ourselves into a little concert party and played all over the place. And, of course, the Italian prisoners weren't treated as well as we were treated. So poor old Giuseppe Selmi looked an absolute disaster. I mean, he just had his army uniform on and he had nothing. So I used to bring him all sorts of fantastic luxuries like socks and underwear. And he started giving me cello lessons again. And then he was sent home and I eventually disappeared somewhere else. And years went by. By that time, I have a son who is a cellist and he won a prize in Italy. Part of the prize was to play the Schumann Concerto with the Florence Orchestra. He knew the people in the orchestra and there was a second time he played with them and he realized there was a different cellist sitting there from the previous time. So he introduced himself, and then Selmi said, "My God, you are the son of Anita," and all this underwear and sock business came out, and Selmi was a lovely man, very ebullient, and he apparently the rehearsal was totally disturbed because he had to tell everybody what happened to the La Madre, who's given him all these things, you know, and he will be eternally grateful. He was a lovely man, and they played the Schumann Concerto, the slow movement, and apparently Selmi said he was so moved he cried because there's a lovely cello duet, you see, in the slow movement.
Part of the slow movement of Schumann's cello concerto in A minor, opus 129, played by Jacqueline Dupré with the new Philharmonia Orchestra, conducted by Daniel Barenboim. How you came to this country, Anita, is another long story, because you had to go on living at Belsen for 9 months after the liberation, but came you did, and you began to make a life here in London, not without huge problems, poverty not least. And then at the age of 22, 23, you became a professional musician and joined the Goldsborough Orchestra, which was to become the English Chamber Orchestra. And you were also to go to Paris and meet a young man whom you'd known at school called the Fat Boy. Tell me about that.
I said to a colleague of mine casually that I'm going to Paris. And he said to me, oh, there's somebody there who you should know from your school, Peter Balfish. I said, oh, yes, the Fat Boy who played the piano. Yes, he's now lives in Paris. He's studying there. So I took his address, not really thinking I was going to look him up. But there I was in Paris, and one day I passed the street where Peter Balfish was staying. And I thought, well, I might as well go in here. And there he was.
Fat?
No, not fat any longer, no, because in the meantime he didn't have all that much to eat either. And we said hello, remember? Oh, yeah, of course, because we used to play together at school, at school concerts. I still have a program where we both appeared, aged 11. And we got on rather well.
And eventually you married.
Eventually we married.
You have two children.
Yes.
Your son, Raphael, of course, is now a well-known cellist. Did you bring them up, your children, speaking German?
No. I have to admit that it would have been totally impossible for me to speak German to my children.
So you didn't speak it to your husband either?
I can't really tell you what I spoke to my husband, how we spoke to each other. I think it was a total mixture of languages.
But you didn't know any English before
the liberation, but I picked it up very quickly.
Yes. So English really has been your language ever since 45?
Yes.
And life since then has been kind to you, I think.
Very kind to me. And in the meantime, I can speak German again. But, you know, in 45, 46, it's, you know, I mean, now things, of course, 50 years later, it's different.
Record number six.
Record number six brings back a very happy time we had in Switzerland when we played for the conductor's course of Raphael Kubelik. I remember he was a very sad man then because he just lost his wife. We had 3 weeks there of conductor's course, which was very interesting. And when that was finished, he said, have we got the music of the Dvořák Serenade anywhere? And we had it. And he said, just let's play it for fun. Professional musicians very rarely play things for fun, and I shall never forget that. It was so wonderful to play something just for fun with Kubelik, who is such a wonderful conductor.
Part of Dvořák's Serenade for Strings in E Major, Opus 22, played by the English Chamber Orchestra, conducted by Raphael Kubelik. You also felt, Anita, for several decades that you could never again set foot on German soil, as I said in the introduction, and you didn't, and nobody could possibly blame you. But can you again describe to me why not? I mean, have you found the words that...
I think the simplest way to explain it, when people tried to persuade me to break my vow, was that it would actually be possible that I meet the very person who have murdered my parents. It could be the newspaper vendor, for all I know. And anybody at the wrong age or white hair would be suspect. I mean, it was not possible for me to go back.
But in the end you did.
In the end I did. You mustn't forget there is a passage of time which does, of course, has a lot to do with it. You see, I go now to Germany when there is a purpose. You know, I've been invited to conferences and stuff like that where you meet young German historians. And I think this is something that I need to do now.
It's a sense of duty. Really.
Absolutely. It's a sense of duty.
You went back, I know, to Belsen. Have you been back to the site of Auschwitz?
Yes. I've been twice to Auschwitz.
Does it help in any way? Or is it just something you were asked to do and you've done it?
You know, I don't need any help in that sense. I'm way past that. It's curiosity, really, that makes me go to these places, just to see what's happened there.
You were, again, naturally full of hatred, as you said, of the Germans immediately after the war. I think you wrote to your sister in England that you hated them without exception. What's happened to that hatred? What happens to that with the passage of time?
I think one has to be a bit careful with hate. I'm a very positive person anyway. I wasn't going to let the Germans, who have destroyed my family, destroy me totally as a person who is embittered and full of hatred, which would hinder my development as a, you know, I wanted to live, really, live to the full. And if you have this poison of hatred in you, it's totally destructive. So I can't say that I hate the Germans, and I can't possibly hate somebody who was born in 1945.
Number 7.
I've chose the Brahms F major sonata played by my husband and my son. That also brings back a most peculiar event, actually, because I was given the record of Casals and Horshovsky playing the Brahms sonatas when I was about 11. And I didn't like the pieces. I absolutely hated them, and I thought, this is terrible. I mean, I'm supposed to be a musician, and I hate this. So I made myself listen to them over and over again till they began to make sense to me. Of course, it is the most wonderful music, but at the age of 11, I don't think you understand that sort of music.
The opening of Brahms' Sonata for Cello and Piano in F Major, Opus 99, played by Raphael Walfisch and Peter Walfisch, the son and late husband of my castaway Anita Lasker Walfisch. Finally, Anita, pressed by people over the last few years to tell your story, that's exactly what you have done, but do I get the impression that you were worried that the truth wouldn't live if you didn't, that people really would stop believing it ever happened?
Yes. I tell you why. What I think is the big danger, that the Holocaust is a sort of happening of the past. You know, it happened many years ago to people that one doesn't really know.
It's a sort of drama. It's almost fiction.
Yes, it's almost like, yeah, fiction is a drama. Oh, it's gas chambers, how terrible, you know. But I think why it is important, I think, to personalize stories is that I think it's impossible for people to really identify with 6,000, 6 million dead people. You know, it is impossible to actually visualize. And I think the only way to perhaps make it understandable is for people to identify with people who were in it and tell the tale, especially young people, you see. I do quite a lot of talking at schools to people who are now my age that I was then. And I say, you see, you sitting at this desk here and you're probably very cross about your Latin exam or whatever, but imagine yourself in a situation where you come home to your normal tea and you find your parents have gone and you have to start battling yourself and you don't know what's happening the next day. You know, then people start to understand perhaps a bit better.
Last record.
The last record is the Beethoven Opus 111 played by my husband. It was one of the last things he did before he had a stroke and could no longer play. And I remember when he first learned the piece many years ago, he worked for months and months and months before he actually played it for the first time at the Wigmore Hall. And a friend of mine to whom I talked yesterday said, you know, I shall never forget this performance. It was so marvelous.
The opening of the slow movement of Beethoven's piano sonata, Opus 111, played by Peter Valfish. So now you have to choose just one of those records, Anita.
I will choose the Opus 111.
That one?
I think I will choose that one, yes.
What about your book?
I had to think very hard about that. You know, I suffer from a terrible inferiority complex as far as my education is concerned, hardly having gone to school, certainly not got any O or A levels. So I thought to take A History of the World by J.M. Roberts. So I might catch up with a little bit of my general knowledge.
And what about your luxury?
I was going to take a bag of Innes number 3 because I love gardening. And some seeds, but then somebody said, well, I suppose something will grow on that island anyway, so I don't bother, and I think I'll have to take the cello. So it'll be the cello, will be the luxury.
Anita Lasker-Valfish, thank you very much indeed for letting us hear your Desert Island Discs.